2. Ants in the Water. The old man reminded Tito of those ghost signs, fading high on the windowless sides of blackened buildings, spelling out the names of products made meaningless by time. If Tito were to see one of those announcing the very latest, the most recent and terrible news, yet could know that it had always been there, fading, through every kind of weather, unnoticed until today, that might feel something like meeting the old man in Washington Square, beside the concrete chess tables, and carefully passing him an iPod beneath a folded newspaper. Each time the old man, expressionless and looking elsewhere, pocketed another iPod, Tito noticed the dull gold of his wristwatch, its dial and hands almost lost behind the worn plastic crystal. A dead man's watch, like the ones jumbled in battered cigar boxes at the flea market. His clothes were like a dead man's as well, cut from fabrics Tito imagined exuding their own chill, a cold distinct from the end of this uneven New York winter, the cold of unclaimed luggage, of institutional corridors, of steel lockers scoured to bare metal. But surely this was costume, the protocol of appearance. The old man could not be genuinely poor and do business with Tito's uncles. Sensing an immense patience and power, Tito imagined that this old man, for reasons of his own, disguised himself as a revenant from Lower Manhattan's past. Each time the old man received another iPod, accepting it the way an ancient and sagacious ape might accept a piece of some not particularly interesting fruit, Tito half expected him to crack its virginal white case like a nut, and then to draw forth something utterly peculiar, utterly dire, and somehow terrible in its contemporaneity. And now, across a steaming tureen of duck soup, in this second-floor restaurant overlooking Canal Street, Tito found himself unable to explain this to Alejandro, his cousin. In his room earlier, he had been layering sounds, attempting to express in music these feelings the old man woke in him. He doubted he would ever play that file for Alejandro. Alejandro, who had never been interested in Tito's music, looked at him now, his brow smooth between shoulder-length, center-parted hair, said nothing, and carefully ladled soup, first into Tito's bowl, then into his own. The world outside the restaurant's windows, beyond words in a red plastic Cantonese neither of them could read, was the color of a silver coin misplaced for decades in a drawer. Alejandro was a literalist, highly talented but supremely practical. This was why he had been chosen to apprentice under Gray Juana, their aunt, the family's master forger. Tito had lugged ancient mechanical typewriters through the downtown streets for Alejandro, impossibly heavy machines purchased in dusty warehouses beyond the river. He had run errands for their inked cloth ribbons and the turpentine Alejandro used to wash out most of their ink. Their native Cuba, Juana taught, had been a kingdom of paper, a bureaucratic maze of forms, of carbon copies and triplicate, a realm the initiate might navigate with confidence and precision. Always precision in the case of Juana, who had herself been trained in the white-painted sub-basements of a building whose upper stories afforded narrow views of the Kremlin. "He frightens you, this old man," Alejandro said. Alejandro had learned Juana's thousand tricks with papers and adhesives, watermarks and stamps, her magic in improvised darkrooms, and darker mysteries involving the names of children who had died in infancy. Tito had sometimes carried, for months on end, decaying wallets bulging with fragments of the identities Alejandro's apprenticeship had generated, prolonged proximity to his body removing every trace of the new. He had never touched the cards and folded papers the heat and movement of his body swayed so convincingly. Alejandro, removing them from their stained envelopes of dead man's leather, had worn surgical gloves. "No," Tito said, "he doesn't frighten me." Though really he wasn't sure. Fear was a part of it, but he didn't seem to fear the old man himself. "Perhaps he should, cousin." The strength of Juana's magic had faded, Tito knew, amid new technologies and an increasing governmental stress on security, by which was meant control. The family relied less now on Juana's skills, obtaining most of their documents, Tito guessed, from others, ones more attuned to present needs. Alejandro, Tito knew, was not sorry about this. At 30, 8 years older than Tito, he had come to regard life in the family as, at best, a mixed blessing. The drawings Tito had seen, taped to fade in sunlight against the windows of Alejandro's apartment, were a part of this. Alejandro drew beautifully, seemingly in any style, and there was an understanding between them, unspoken, that Alejandro had begun to carry the subtleties of Juana's magic uptown into a world of galleries and collectors. Carlito, Alejandro named an uncle now, carefully, passing Tito a small white china bowl of greasy scented warmth. What has Carlito told you about him? That he speaks Russian. They were speaking Spanish. That if he addresses me in Russian, I may reply in Russian. Alejandro raised an eyebrow. And that he knew our grandfather in Havana. Alejandro frowned, his white china spoon poised above his soup. An American? Tito nodded. The only Americans our grandfather knew in Havana were CIA, Alejandro said. More softly now, though there was no one else in the restaurant other than the waiter, who was reading a Chinese weekly on his stool behind the till. Tito remembered going with his mother to the Chinese cemetery behind Calle 23, shortly before he had come to New York. Something had been retrieved from an ossuary there, one of the small houses of bones, and Tito had delivered this elsewhere, proud of his tradecraft. And in the reeking toilet behind a Malecón restaurant, he had flicked through the papers, in their mildewed envelope of rubberized fabric. He had no idea what they might have been, now, but he knew they had been typed in an English he'd scarcely known how to read. He had never told this to anyone, and now did not tell Alejandro. His feet in black Red Wing boots were very cold. He imagined himself slipping luxuriously into a deep Japanese bath of this same duck soup. "He looks like the men who used to stand in the hardware stores along this street," he said to Alejandro. "Old men in old coats with nothing else to do." The hardware stores of Canal were gone now, replaced by cellular shops and counterfeit Prada. "If you were to tell Carlito that you had seen the same van twice or even the same woman," Alejandro told the steaming surface of his soup, "he would send someone else. The protocol demands it." Their grandfather, too, was gone, the author of that protocol, like those old men along Canal Street. His complexly illegal ashes had been flung, one chilly April morning, from a Staten Island ferry, the uncles shielding ritual cigars against the wind, while the vessel's resident pickpockets hung well back, away from what they rightly perceived to be a most private activity. "There has been nothing," Tito said. "Nothing to indicate any interest. If someone pays us to pass this man contraband, and by the nature of our business we pass nothing else, then someone else is surely interested." Tito tested the joints of his cousin's logic, finding them sound. He nodded. "You know the expression, get a life, cousin?" Alejandro had switched to English. "We all need lives, Tito, eventually, if we're to stay here." Tito said nothing. "How many deliveries so far?" "Four." "Too many." They ate their soup in silence then, hearing trucks rumble over metal along Canal. Later, Tito stood before the deep sink in his single tall room in Chinatown, washing winter socks with woolite. Socks were no longer quite so foreign in themselves, but the weight of these, wet, still amazed him. And still his feet were sometimes cold, in spite of a variety of insulated insoles from the surplus store on Broadway. He remembered the sink in his mother's apartment in Havana, the plastic bottle filled with the henequen sap she used as a detergent, the pad of coarse fibers from the interior of the same plant, and a small can of charcoal. He remembered the tiny ants speeding along the edge of his mother's sink. In New York, Alejandro had once pointed out, ants moved much more slowly. Another cousin, relocated from New Orleans in the wake of the flood, had spoken of seeing a swarming, glittering ball of red ants in the water. This was how ants avoided drowning, it seemed, and Tito, hearing the story, had thought that his family was like that as well. Afloat in America, less numerous but supported by one another on their invisible raft of tradecraft, the protocol. Sometimes he watched the news in Russian, on the Russian network of America, on his Sony plasma screen. The voices of the presenters had begun to acquire a dreamlike submarine quality. He wondered if this was what it felt like to begin to lose a language. He rolled his socks, squeezed water and suds from them, emptied and refilled the sink, put them back in to rinse, and dried his hands on an old T-shirt he used as a towel. The room was square, windowless, with a single steel door and white painted plasterboard walls. The high ceiling was raw concrete. He sometimes lay on his mattress, staring up, and traced the edges of vanished sheets of plywood there, fossil impressions dating from the pouring of the floor above. There were no other live-in residents. His floor neighbors were a factory where Korean women sewed children's clothing, and another smaller firm, something to do with the Internet. His uncles held the lease here. When they required a place to do certain kinds of business, Tito sometimes slept at Alejandro's, on his cousin's IKEA couch. His own room had a sink and toilet, a hot plate, a mattress, his computer, amp, speakers, keyboards, the Sony television, an iron, an ironing board. His clothing hung on an ancient wheeled iron rack rescued from the sidewalk on Crosby Street. Beside one of his speakers stood a small blue vase from a Chinese department store on Canal, a fragile thing he had secretly dedicated to the goddess Ochun, she whom Cuban Catholics knew as Our Lady of Charity at Cobre. He cabled his Casio keyboard, added warmer water to the rinsing socks, pulled a long-legged folding director's chair close to the sink and climbed up into it. Perched in the tall, unsteady chair from that same Canal Street department store, he settled into the sling of black canvas and lowered his feet into the water. With the Casio across his thighs, he closed his eyes and touched the keys, searching for a tone like tarnished silver. If he played well, he would fill Ochun's emptiness.